This is the podcast for Wednesday, January 23rd, 2013, Theory of Knowledge. So we had a little tech glitch, so I lost a little bit of the beginning of the recording for today's class. So just to recap, I was talking about what to do to study for the exam. And what you should do is review those questions for discussion at the end of each section of the text. Pay special attention to particular big philosophers we've talked to, like Descartes, their views, technical terms, and definitions, things like rationalism, empiricism, the correspondence theory of truth, relativism, a priori, a posteriori, and then on the material unlocked today, and knowing the difference between a simple idea and a complex idea, between a quality and an object, between primary and secondary qualities, ideas of sensation and ideas of reflection, and so on. And then some of the pro and con arguments, like what are Descartes' arguments for God's existence? And so one, he says only God could, that we can have created our idea of God, that only God could have created that idea in our minds because an imperfect human being can't create an idea of a perfect God. It's a perfect idea. And the imperfect cannot create the perfect. So that's one of his arguments. And then the other one is the ontological argument. And those are the two important arguments for Descartes. The argument from the idea of God that only an actually infinite and perfect being could have created my idea of an infinite and perfect being. And the ontological argument. You should also pay special attention to the section of the text on the correspondence theory of truth. Many students miss the first several questions on the exam, which are about that, because they confuse these terms, which seem that they're things that we think about every day. Truth, knowledge, belief, but these have very particular meanings in philosophy, and it's important to be clear about them. So remember, when you're taking the exam, you'll be asked, say, according to the correspondence theory of truth, and it's asking you to think from that perspective. So don't give me your perspective. Don't think about the way things are. It will ask you, what would a person who thinks, who believes in the correspondence theory of truth, what would they think about this? So when you think about what, there was actually a question on the exam, a sample question about this. So make sure, too, to take that practice test. There'll be about 50 questions on the test. That sample test only gave you 5 questions. It says practice tests. Those are for practice. They help you gauge how well you're doing in the class. If you got all 5 right the first time, then good for you. You're on the right track. If you got maybe 3 or 4, you're doing okay, but maybe you need to work, especially if you got 3. If you're doing 2 or 1, then you've got some major problems that need addressing. So, and hopefully, you were able to see as you retook the quiz, that practice quiz, what you did wrong, or go back in the book and look at the answer and so on. Of course, you won't be able to do that on the exam. So that's why it's important to go through the text, go through those questions for review, and make sure that you can answer them, and even write out the answers if that's helpful to you. Then I recommend that as a method for studying. And then make your 3x5 card. You're allowed a 3x5 note card, both sides for the exam. Put your name or some identifying mark on it if you want it back, because they'll collect that at the end of the exam. You can use a computer to make super small font on it, but no magnifying devices are allowed during the exam. See what else about. Make sure to arrive an hour before the lab closes. And you have until next Wednesday, when the lab closes at 7 to complete your exam. And contact me if you need an extension before the deadline. Not an extension before the deadline, but contact me before the deadline if you need an extension. And I'll be happy to grant one, and we can work out a time that you can take the test by. And we joined the podcast in progress, and I just started talking about Descartes and his rationalism. Okay, part two. So Descartes, a rationalist, he thinks that you can do philosophy like you do geometry, like you do arithmetic. You just chain together a bunch of steps. And Descartes was a mathematician, so it makes sense, right? So he thinks mathematics, you know, you have a proof, you chain together a bunch of steps. You start out with some simple axioms like the longest distance between two points on a plane is a straight line, right? So you can just think about it. You think about two points, you think about like a flat surface, what's going to be the shortest distance? It's going to be a straight line between the two. And you start with basic axioms like that, and then you eventually get it to something like a squared plus b squared equals c squared or something. Pythagorean theorem. That's really complex. Now, you can prove that Pythagorean theorem is valid, which says that you know, you can't intuitively see that if you have a triangle with an angle that's 90 degrees here, that the length of this line is equal to the length of these two lines squared and added together. Intuitively, you just can't see that that's true. You have to go through a bunch of steps in geometry to prove that that's true. But once you go through all those steps, then you could arrive at something like this, and this is going to be really useful if you're a carpenter or what have you. But it helps you deduce a new truth about proof about triangles that you didn't already know by chaining together these intuitive steps. Descartes thinks you can do the same thing with the world. When you're doing philosophy, you start out with your basic axiom, and for him it's, I think, therefore I am. I exist. Okay, well, I exist. What else can I get from that? Well, I know I exist and I have sensations. And I notice that some sensations seem under my control and other ones don't. What can I deduce from that? And I think, well, maybe my sensations are coming from God. And is there a God? Can I prove whether there's a God or not? And he just sort of goes through the steps. Okay, well, could God possibly not exist? And then he gives you all these proofs for God's existence. But he's chained together all these deductions that that instead of, like, think about like an empiricist. So if you're, none of this has to do with the senses. In order to prove something in geometry, you draw some lines and things, but those are just sort of to help you think. You don't really need the lines in geometry. Or in the same way, you don't really need to write Arabic numerals to do mathematics. You can do it all in your head. These are just markers that help you think. Descartes thinks you can do philosophy like that, as opposed to the empiricists that say it's all about your senses. It's all about looking for evidence. It's all about having enough evidence to prove something. And it's about observation. So instead of like a proof for, you know, if you're going to try to prove God, you know, you might, as an empiricist, maybe look for proof of miracles or something like that. Or maybe you look at like the Big Bang theory, something like that. And see if there's evidence of intelligent design in the world. All those would be empiricist arguments for God's existence. Descartes' proof is think about the concept of God. All right, could God be imaginary? And he says, well, no, God couldn't be imaginary because then he wouldn't be a perfect being. That's like essentially the ontological argument. That if you think about the concept of God and the concept of existence, you see that they go together like a mountain and a valley, like a triangle and three sides, that they're inseparable. That you can't consistently think about God as not existing because God's this ultimate being. And an ultimate being would have to exist in reality. Yeah.
So a rationalist, unlike an empiricist, would believe that experience and sensation have nothing to do with knowledge. And reason and proofs are what prove knowledge.
Right. Reason and logic. Whereas the empiricist...
sensation and experience, is it?
Yeah. Or you just say sense experience. Now, it's not like that Descartes uses his senses somewhat. Like, he did anatomy, and he, like, dissected animals and even human cadavers to try to figure out how they work. So as a scientist, he's still looking at things, but he says to start out with, you have to... The most important principles are abstract, logical principles, not things your senses tell you. And if you just go in your senses, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. Whereas the empiricists say that the senses are really, really important. Yeah.
Would an empiricist's reflection, as the Lockean talks about, be along the lines of the rationalist's reason and logic?
Actually, Locke wants to say that that reflection is a kind of an inner experience of the workings of your own mind, and he wants to call that an experience as opposed to, like, reason or logic. So
it just seems very similar. Like, an inner experience seems a lot like your inner reason.
I suppose Locke would say ideas are reflection or how it feels to reason, but they're not the same as reasoning. So both these guys believe in reasoning, like there's a faculty of the human mind to reason. Locke would say, how do you get the concept of thought, for example? And Locke says, well, you get the concept of thought by thinking. And what happens is your mind does these things, and then you sort of step out your side of yourself and say, what am I going to call this thing that I do all the time? And you say, well, I'm just going to call it thought. What do all these things going on in my mind have in common? And you have, like, a distinction between a thought and a feeling. And it's not something you observe in the outside world. It's not like you look at a bunch of shapes and colors and you form the concept of thought. You form the concept of thought by experiencing your own thoughts. And so, whereas Descartes would say the concept of thought is an innate idea that was planted in your mind at birth.
And the Locke doesn't believe in innate idea.
Right.
Would reflection be a sense experience then? Because is it like the feeling, yeah, the emotion that you're sensing from the thought?
Let's see. Is it a...
So like the reflection would be what you feel from a thought? Or am I just...
Locke would say it's an experience, but it's not a sensation. So he wants to... use the word sensation to apply it to the five senses. So he says there's two kinds of ideas. There's ideas of sensation, which are ideas we get from the five senses. And then there's ideas of reflection, which we get from observing the inner workings of our own mind. Which we'll get to in due course. I want to finish up with Descartes here, though. Any other questions about Descartes or about rationalism? Oh, right. A priori and a posteriori. So an a priori, this means apart from sense experience and, a triangle has three sides. Or how about... a contradiction can't be true. A thing is identical with itself. Or, if A or B and not B, then what?
It's A.
A, yeah. So this is a disjunctive syllogism in logic. So these are things, Descartes would say, how did you learn these things? Did you look at a bunch of shapes and colors? And he says those are all innate. Logic, mathematics, your basic rational categories, it's all innate. and this is a priori. It's something that you know apart from experience. And no new experience is going to change your mind about these things. Now, Descartes never been, to a Buddhist monastery, so people tell me they chant Om long enough, and they say, oh no, contradiction can't be true, or the truth is beyond logic, or they start spouting other things that make absolutely no sense, and you try to say, well, how could that make sense? And they say, well, come to be with me to the monastery, and we'll chant Om together, and you'll see. and I politely decline. Although maybe someday I'll try it and see how it goes. But the idea is that these are things that you couldn't suddenly wake up tomorrow scientists prove contradiction can be true. Or, you'd say I thought, all these years I thought I was myself, but I came out of my sociology class and I realized I was someone else. And not that you were different than you thought you were, but that you weren't identical with yourself. Uh-huh. Right? It's like a thing is identical with itself, A equals A. it's fundamental logic, and that's something that's true regardless of what you couldn't have any new experience which would change your mind about it. It's something that you know independent of experience. Yeah.
What about people that get sex changes?
Those are people that have a change. And they're still identical with themselves at any given moment of time. So this A equals A doesn't say that things can't change. It just says that at any moment in time, a thing is itself. Or it's just sort of the law. It's called the law of identity, that a thing is itself. And then you get the law of non-contradiction, which is that A cannot be equivalent to not A. Let's see, is that right? Yeah. So a thing can't be equivalent to its opposite. So all these logical things, or if you have two choices, right? You do this all the time intuitively. You think, if these are indeed the only two choices, somebody give me an example of two mutually exclusive choices when you're trying to figure out something.
Left or right,
paper or plastic, right? So that's something, when you're trying to figure out something, whether something's true or not. Think about this recorder, for example, right? So the recorder goes off, and I say, and suppose I put a black mark on my new shirt. Oh, that's terrible. These things never come out, too.
It should,
I'm a temper. This is dry. It says dry. It says non-toxic, low odor.
Dry erase.
That probably means it'll never come out. What was I? The choice. So mutual exclusive choice. So suppose I look at my recorder here and I say, okay, it's turned off now, and I just got back from the factory, so I say it's nothing wrong with it. So it's either the battery or the card's full, right? And if I check the battery's good, then the card's got to be full, right? If not, if it's either A or B, and it's not A, it has to be B. That's not something any new experience is going to change your mind about. Now, you might have a new experience with a recorder. You'd say, the factory gave it back to me, but they didn't fix it right. Or it could be my batteries are malfunctioning or something like that. And if I put another pair of batteries in there, it's good. But when you're trying to isolate a problem, you use logic like this all the time. The logic isn't going to change, and your experiences aren't going to make you revise these things. These are set in stone. These are things that you're 100% certain of. It's that. It's the senses, the rationals will say, that you can't be really certain of. And so the senses have to play a secondary role. So that the a posteriori beliefs. These are things which are based on sense experience. Somebody give me an example of an a posteriori belief.
The color of the sky.
Yeah, the sky is gray today or something like that.
It's raining.
It's raining.
So what, weather would be a good example?
It's raining.
or
yeah, so any sense experience you're having, these things are temporary. They come and go.
Like I'm cold. Like
that. Yeah, I'm cold. Right. Anything which isn't about a truth of logic or mathematics, it's based on something you've observed. Those are a posteriori beliefs. And this is going to come up a little later on when we talk about Hume. But right now, the thing to remember is for the rationalist, it's for rationalism, it's the a priori. They love a priori reasoning, a priori beliefs. They think they're really important. For the empiricist, it's a posteriori that's important. It's the senses. And the empiricist is going to say, you chain together a bunch of posteriori senses, and your mind kind of puts them together, and you form abstract concepts. And that's where concepts come from. They're not innate ideas. They're just sort of your mind sifting through all these different experiences and putting together and forming concepts from the ground up. And that actually your idea of equality comes from you're seeing things and seeing them match up certain ways. And you see two things which look pretty close, other things which look far away, and you see, say, these two things. You think, well, they're equal in some ways or unequal in other ways. And your mind just sort of takes all these experiences of objects that look similar, more similar, and less similar, and you form the abstract idea of same, different, of larger, smaller, of equal and unequal, and so on. And that's where all your concepts from the basic concepts of size and shape to your concepts of justice and love, all those things come from sensation, seeing shapes and colors and hearing sounds and feeling things. See it? Oh, Descartes, the piece of wax. That's an important example. So, what's the example of the piece of wax and why is it important? Anyone want to take a shot at that one? He like melts a piece of wax. It's one of the questions at the end of the section they should know the answers to.
The wax changes form, but it's still wax.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. The wax changes form. All of its sensory properties change, but it's the same substance. Now, if knowledge really came from the senses, you wouldn't know that it's the same thing, right? Do your senses tell you it's the same piece of wax? No, your senses say, oh, wait a minute, we had something that was like white and now it's transparent. We had something that was sort of like putty and now it's a liquid. We had something that was cool and now it's hot. We had something that you like flick with your finger and made it like a thwacking sound. You flick the liquid wax and just, it splatters all over your face and burns you or something. It makes a puddly sound or something. So it has completely different sets of properties. How do you know it's the same piece of wax? Well, Descartes says it's your reason. It's your mind tells you that, and that's a priori reason. That's recognizing the concept of a substance, and it's something that you use to categorize your experience. The concept of a substance, and it's not something you observe. It's something that your mind imposes on the world, that concept of substance. So our basic argument for the piece of wax is knowledge doesn't come from the senses, it comes from reason. It's your mind that tells you it's the same piece of wax, that wax is a substance which can undergo change and have different properties but be the same thing. And the concept of a substance which can undergo change and change its properties is an abstract a priori concept. Let's see, the men in hats and coats. That's a funny one too. So Descartes talks about like looking down from like a balcony from a high window. Some guy looking down. I don't know what I'm drawing here. So somebody's looking down, there's people, they're walking the street, and they've got, some hats, and they're wearing like the long cloaks. Maybe they got like a walking stick, right? They're just kind of walk along. And this guy, what's he seeing when he's looking down there? He's just seeing, something like this, maybe, right? And you see a bunch of these shapes that look like people walking back and forth. So how does he know? How does he know what's underneath the hats and coats? The parrot asks. And he says, maybe it's not like, you know, some guy appeared here or something. There, right? Maybe it's really it's like a robot. Robot hat. He's got the same hat and cloak on, right? But maybe it's an automaton, roll on wheels. And they have the sort of thing, you know, in the 16th century, they had like these toys for basically rich kids that sort of would wind up and move around and stuff like that. That worked like sort of like a clock or a watch. So they called them mechanical men or what's another word for clockwork men. And so basically somebody took the principles of a clock that made the hand spin around, and they made like these little miniature princes and for little miniature princes. And they would, you know, smile and move back and forth, and their eyes would like go back and forth and things like that. And so he says, well, how do you know this is like a giant mechanical man and not a real man? Well, what would you say?
Reason.
Yeah, it's reason. And it's not... Your mind really just shows you some funny shapes. Even the idea of seeing an object at a distance and knowing that that object, even though it looks small in your field of vision, would actually be larger if you're up next to it. This idea of perspective is also something that your mind does. It's not something your senses show you. Your senses just show you shape and colors. It's your mind that puts them all together and says, oh, that... Even though these men look really tiny from my eye window, they're not actually tiny. They just look tiny because I'm a long ways away. That's your mind. And then when you, how do you know they're not automatons? Well, it's like background knowledge. Your mind integrates all the experiences you had before and lets you know this is what, you know, someone I'd see in the street would look like this looks like when I'm staring down at them. And it's your memory, it's your background information about the world all being integrated into a coherent whole. And again, that's reason. It's not just seeing shapes and colors and having experiences of sound and touch. And if knowledge really did come from those things, then you would, you know, you wouldn't be able to know that. But since you do know it, it shows that knowledge is based on reason and not the senses.
Is that the same as a dream? But the brain and the bat, is that related to the dream argument you mentioned earlier?
So the brain and the bat is related to the arch-deceiver argument.
Okay.
So you have two arguments. The dream argument says, what if all the experiences I'm having aren't really real, but they're something like a dream, they're all an illusion, and how would I know it? And the arch-deceiver argument sort of ups the ante and says, what if it's not just an illusion, but there's a person a million times smarter than me whose purpose in life is to fool me into thinking it's real? How would I ever know that? And then that's why he comes up with the I think, therefore I am. So it's just his way of trying to get himself to doubt everything. And then see, what is there anything that a person a million times smarter than me could make me believe, or that couldn't make me believe? And he says, well, he couldn't make me believe that I am nothing when I am something. I think, therefore, I am. The two arguments for God's existence, I think I'll just ask about like the one that only the idea of a perfect and infinite being could have only come from an infinite and perfect being. This idea that the idea of God is of a perfect and infinite being, and that I as an imperfect and finite being couldn't have come up with the idea on my own. So man couldn't have created the idea of God because man doesn't have that capability, being finite and imperfect. So that's one of his arguments. The other one is the ontological argument that God as a perfect being would have to exist. And there's more details in the text. But those are the two I'll ask about on the exam. And you can see, again, rationalism, right? how do I know whether a God exists? Do I look out for evidence, like for evidence of intelligent design, evidence that God created the Big Bang? Am I looking at my telescope? Am I looking around in nature to try to see if it seems random or if it seems designed? No, I'm just thinking about the concept of God. I think of my concept of God. Where did that come from? Could I have created that concept? Oh, I couldn't have done it because I'm imperfect and God's perfect. And the perfect cannot create the perfect. Again, you know, sort of a syllogism. The idea of God is perfect. I am not perfect. The perfect can only come from the perfect. Therefore, I couldn't have created my idea of God. That sort of thing. That's basic intuition and deduction. Logical syllogisms. Let's move on to empiricism, since I don't want to give Locke the short shrift. So the exam is going to cover Chapter 3, Empiricism, only through Locke. So I'll give you the capsule summary of Locke, and then you can always send me a Moodle message if you have any questions. I know we have an abbreviated week on empiricism here, although we'll be getting Berkeley here next week. We're a little short on time for Locke because of the Martin Luther King Day weekend. So, let's see. So, Locke's an empiricist. Knowledge comes from the senses. Empiricists believe knowledge comes from the senses and that reason plays a minor role. The opposite of rationalism. John Locke is an empiricist. Descartes a rationalist. So Locke starts out with an attack on innate ideas. What's he have to say about innate ideas?
They don't exist.
What is an innate idea?
You're born with.
They're ideas you're born with. And again, the things like logic, mathematics, maybe morality. You've probably heard people say things like this. Everyone's born with an innate sense of right and wrong. Right? That's innate ideas. No matter where you look in the world, people recognize that there's a power greater than themselves. Right? Even the most primitive tribe has something they worship, something beyond the material realm. We've never uncovered a tribe of atheists. Even though they're individual atheists, there are no societies that deny God's existence. Everybody has an innate idea of God. People will say that. Or of the ultimate, or of a higher power, or what have you. So these are good candidates for innate ideas. So what are Locke's arguments against innate ideas? Yeah, all of them.
Children and infants don't have them.
Yeah, so we can say not everyone has them. And the examples he gives, children, idiots, and just idiots is an old-timey word for people with mental handicaps. So, and it's like retired now. It's like every time you come up with a new name, people start using it as an insult, and you got to find something else. I think now it's like, the differently abled is going to become the new insult. Then what do you go to? I don't know. But, retarded now, it's a big movement to get the word banned and to get people to not use it as a pejorative. So anyway, so you get someone like a very small child or an infant maybe, right? You go up to your newborn son or daughter and say, what do you think, Johnny? 'Tis impossible for a thing to both be and not be. And he's going to, maybe he'll spit upon you or something, right? He doesn't know. A small child, you show him the Pythagorean theorem, he scratches his head, he's not really sure. So how is it that's innate in his mind? And then you get a person who's either got a mental defect or is a slow learner, and they don't get these so-called innate ideas either. And so, so that's one of his basic arguments. He also says, though, if everyone had them, that wouldn't prove they're innate. Now, why would that be? Suppose, like, everybody had them. Yeah.
Well, because they could be, in fact, acquired by the senses, all living in the same reality.
Yeah, so you could just say that even if everybody had them, you haven't proved that they're innate. Everybody could have them from just having all the same experiences. And then he's going to give you like a positive way to show you how this indeed happens. Yeah?
He says that ideas you can't imprint things on your mind without the mind perceiving it first.
Mm-hmm. That you never have an idea without a perception. So you have the perception first, and then you form the idea. And so since people have all these perceptions, so you put this in another one, perceptions precede ideas. So he has like his native program where he says, okay, here are all the reasons why innate ideas are a bad idea, why they don't really exist, there's no such thing. And now I'm going to tell you how our innate ideas are actually created. And so he thinks about a concept like equality. I talked about that earlier, so maybe I'll pick something else. The concept of... pick an abstract concept.
Freedom.
Well, that's really abstract. that's a good concept. I take the concept of freedom. So when you're born, you sort of try to do things and you can't, and then maybe as you grow up, you have like your parents tell you no, like you really want the cookie and it looks delicious, and your parents says no, it'll spoil your dinner, and you slap. Maybe you're like in the candy store, or like the grocery store, you see some candy, or you see something pretty with colors, and you reach out. Somebody slaps the hand down and says, no, right? And you go, I don't like that, right? And then, as you go up, you look outside, and it's a beautiful sunny day, you want to go outside and play, and as you get up from your desk and try to stare out the window longingly, your teacher says, get back in your seat, right? And so you get this idea of like maybe being constrained and not having freedom. And then you can also think of the times where you're sort of free to run around and you have recess time, right? Recess time is when you get to be free, at least when teachers aren't looking or something, right? You can run around. So you have this idea of, people telling me what to do, tell me to do things I don't want to do, like eat my vegetables and brush my teeth and yada, yada, yada. And then all the times I get to do what I want to do, I get to run and play and be free. And then, as an adult, you get this sort of idea of, freedom or liberty, which is be able to do what you want to do and not having somebody else, like, Uncle Sam or some bureaucrat or policeman telling you how to do your stuff, right? And that's just sort of the idea of freedom. As an abstract concept, or liberty, you might say. And so that freedom as an abstract concept, like the thing that sparked the Revolutionary War, this ideal of freedom, it's sort of hard to wrap your mind around. But Locke says you get that idea from all the experiences you had of people either be able to do what you want to do or not be able to do what you want to do. And your mind kind of puts those things together and drops out all the things that aren't particular. It drops out all the particulars and holds on to the universal, as we might say. So, like, it takes out, running at recess, or playing at recess. It takes out, when you think about the freedom of recess, it takes out the things like, it's a 12 o'clock, because that's not really part of being free. The part about being free is the feeling of no constraints. And it takes out the part about how long it lasts, right? But this idea that of freedom is that I can do what I want and nobody's going to tell me what to do. And so that, so anyway, the basic idea is that the abstract concept, it picks out one thing and drops out the rest. Just like a triangle, right? You think about a triangle can look a lot of different ways. And so your mind sort of picks out the thing which is the same from all these figures different triangles. And says, okay, it's a three-sided figure. It takes all the parts about this, you know, it doesn't matter that this one's really small, this one's really big, this one has a right angle, that this one doesn't. No, it drops out all those, or this one's long, this one's short. It takes out all that stuff and just says three sides. That's a triangle. And the same thing with freedom. It's just the lacking of constraint. But you don't start out with the concept of freedom and innate in your mind. You just have experiences of being able to do things and not being able to do things. Of people forcing you to do things you don't want to do and be able to do what you want to do. And that's where the concept of freedom comes from. It's learned experientially. Make sense? Questions? Disputations? Okay. Innate ideas. Let's talk about Locke's classification of ideas. Okay, and this is about maybe as... This is probably about as complicated as things get here. So the ideas... You have ideas of sensation and ideas of reflection. Reflection. So the ideas of reflection are just concepts, things like thought, doubt, the concept of thinking and doubting, or that's separate. Just thought, doubt, what are some other mental categories?
Emotion.
The concept of a mind. I'm not sure about emotion. Emotion actually Locke doesn't really deal with. I'm not sure. Well, let's leave feeling aside for a minute. He's controversial. Yeah, the concept of reason, logic, morality. Yeah, I think. Where would Locke put morality? That's not really a mental concept. I mean, it's a really interesting question. Like, what would an empiricist say? Where would they say morality comes from? Especially somebody like Locke. Hume actually has the idea of morality. It's different. Where he actually says it comes from the senses. Well, let's leave that aside. That's a good question. But basically, any mental category, how about the idea of a decision? Right? Like you make a mental decision or intention. Volition. So all these are things that your mind does. It thinks, it doubts, it wonders, it,
would choice be somewhere in between?
Decision is choice. Oh, it's a decision, choice, if you like. I think it's the same. Choice. How about deliberation? Deliberation. Where you're trying to make, you're sort of mulling over something. Mulling. So you're trying to, like I was trying to make a decision, and you know, some might say waffling, right? There's an old Abbott and Costello bit where some mugger pulls out a gun on Abbott and Costello. I can't remember. Costello's the little guy, and he says, "Your money, your life." And he's like sticking the gun in his face, and there's this long pause, and he says, "I'm thinking it over." But it's just like, think about when you're deliberating over a decision, you're trying to figure out. That's a mental thing that goes on. And Locke says you know these things not by observing the external world, but by sort of looking inward and having experience of the operations of your own mind. So this is a special case, because Locke just couldn't figure out how to account as an empiricist for mental categories. And so he said, okay, well, all these things, I'm going to call these ideas reflection, and push him aside. Ideas of sensation is where he does most of his talking. So that's what he most of his theory is about. Ideas of sensation. And so you have let's put this up here. Ideas of sensation. Well, there's two kinds. What are they? One starts with an S and one starts with a C.
Simple ideas and complex ideas.
Simple and complex. What would be an example of a simple idea?
A chair.
Yeah. Why is a chair a complex idea?
Because it involves a series of simple ideas. Like, it's blue, it's rock.
Air would be simple.
Right. Air, simple or complex?
Complex.
Because it involves multiple elements? Or?
Yeah, it involves multiple perceptions, I think. Or, I don't know, you can see the air, you can see its effect. I think it would probably be a complex idea. But that might be a tricky one.
Simple idea can be like...
So these are the simple idea of qualities. Mm-hmm. So actually, air, I think, would be a complex idea because it's an idea of a substance that has certain properties, that has different kinds of properties. Simple ideas, ideas of individual qualities.
Toughness. Coldness.
No, but individual. Individual qualities. And so the individual and simple, remember those go together. Complex, these are ideas of objects. Like the cap on my pen. So this is an object, you know, the cap of my pen, the chair. So the chair has qualities like being, you know, blue, and being made of plastic or rough or whatever, hard. Especially sitting in it for an hour and 20 minutes. You know, it's not the most comfortable chairs in here, right? And then you have the simple qualities would be things like blueness or roughness or hardness, etc. So these are ideas of qualities. So the quality is a thing out there in the world, and the idea is a thing in your mind. And you're having a you have a true belief when the thing in your mind matches up with the thing out there in the world. So an idea of blueness is a simple idea. Combined with the idea of roughness and hardness and a certain shape and so on, you get the idea of the chair. The complex idea of the chair is made up of a series of simple ideas. The idea of the chair represents an object, a material object out there in the world. The simple ideas represent the qualities that that material object has. Questions so far?
Can you repeat?
So a complex idea represents an object out there in the world, like a chair. So complex ideas represent objects out there in the world. Simple ideas represent the qualities the object has. Simple ideas represent qualities, individual qualities that the object has. So its blueness, its roughness, its hardness, those are all qualities a chair has. Each of those, there's a simple idea corresponding with quality. So there's a quality of blueness, there's an idea of blueness. There's a quality of roughness, you have an idea of roughness. There's a quality of hardness, you have an idea of hardness. All those are simple ideas. You also have an idea of a chair, which is all those things combined. And that's the idea of the object that has these qualities. Now, how about the idea of substance? It
must exist to unite and support qualities. So, the complex idea of a chair, unites the qualities of the reality.
Yeah, it's the something I know not. Oops, I know not what. Got ahead of myself. Something I know not what, which supports qualities. No, not what. It's a something I know not what. This is a big question mark. Something which supports qualities. So.
And it must exist in order to unite the qualities?
Yeah, something you suppose exists. So you have all these ideas, right? Okay, there's blueness, roughness, hardness, and they make up the complex idea of the chair. So there's the real qualities, and then there's the real chair. But there's got to be something more to the chair than just the qualities, right? There's like the real chair. So like, is this just like blueness and silveriness and a sort of roughness and stuff? But in addition to all the qualities that the chair has, there's the real chair. What does it mean to say there's a real chair here? It's just to say that the chair has substance. It's real. It's made out of matter. All those are different ways of talking about something having substance. Or even saying the chair is an external object. That's another way of saying it's a substance. So we could even say of objects, we call them substances. So there's individual objects or substances, but they're part of substance. Like substance is this idea of the material world. Substance. Oh, here we go. The material world. Matter. To say that the something is real, to say it's made of matter, it has substance. But he says, but what does it really mean to be made out of matter, to have substance, to be real? And he says, when you think about this, we're sort of talking like children, and you say, I don't know, it's really there. Right? You really can't say what you mean when you say something has substance, except for you're just saying that it exists. And so that's where the bit about he used this analogy of the Indian. This is an East Indian, and so he says this guy who's, he's picking on the poor old Indians as being, uneducated, right? So Britain was, I think at the time, I guess they had colonies, early colonies in India. But so you have this guy who's sort of, superstitious, maybe not well educated, and he has a story about, the world rests on the world rests on the back of a broad-backed tortoise, right? And you say, what's on top of the tortoise? The tortoise steps on the back of a giant elephant. And you're like, well, what's under the elephant? And he says, something I know not what, right? So the idea is you keep on going down, and then eventually you get to something where you just sort of throw up your hands and say, it's like what stuff's made out of. It's real, and it's there. You start waving your hands around like Joe Cocker, during a performance. and you can't say anything else. And so that's why he calls it the something I know not what. So substance is just this idea of material substance or matter, just the idea of an object being real. That's his. Now, as an empiricist, how do you get to this? That's the question. And the answer is you don't. So one of the things I suggest in the I think I've got this someplace in the text, or if not, I'll tell you now, that it's not a very empiricist idea. You can't see substance. You can see qualities. You can see shapes and colors and so on. Can you see the abstract concept of substance? Can you see matter? You only see matter through its qualities, through its having shape and size and texture. You can't really see the substance of the chair. You can only perceive its qualities. But Locke says, look, it's crazy to go back to Descartes' dream argument. It's crazy to think the world's all one hallucination. It's got to be real. What's giving you these experiences you're having from moment to moment? That's substance. That's the material world that's giving you those experiences.
So basically substance makes the world real?
Yeah, substance is what causes you to have the perceptions that you have. Yeah.
So it's kind of like substance doesn't really justify that there's chairs, but it does justify the simple ideas or the qualities that we're perceiving or thinking about. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that's quite right. I think Locke would say that you can't conceive of the qualities sort of hanging out there in the ether without existing in something. So you have like qualities, right? You have the complex ideas are just of objects. So that's the concept of substance. Could you just have a world that was all qualities and simple ideas?
No, you have to have complex ideas to have those qualities.
But the complex idea is of an object which has those qualities. So it's that concept of complex ideas are concepts of particular substances. So the concept of substance is this one right over here. Substances. You can imagine a world of just qualities. Or actually, next week we'll see that you can when we talk about Berkeley. Berkeley says all your experiences are just ideas planted in your mind by God. So we're back to the dream argument again. Except for Berkeley says, it's not an illusion. It's only illusion if you believe in this world of external matter that philosophers like Locke try to trick you into believing. As long as you don't believe that there's a world of matter, you can just take the ideas as they are, coming directly from God, and the ideas are the real world. So that's jumping ahead a little bit. So Berkeley won't be on the test. So just remember, the idea of substance is something that Locke as an empiricist probably shouldn't believe in, just because he says you should only believe in what you can sense, and you can't sense the idea of substance. There's no sense experience that you can point to that says that's my idea of an object. An object is an abstract concept that comes from the mind, and Locke says because we can't imagine qualities existing by themselves, we suppose there's some substance in which they do exist. Well, when you say you can't imagine this is true, so you suppose something else is true, or you theorize or posit, that's like something like Descartes would say, right? It's you're saying we'll have to hypothesize or suppose or intuit through reason that there has to be a real world out there apart from our sensations. So as a good empiricist, Locke, you know, may have missed the boat on this one. All right, that's all we have time for today. Good luck on the exam, and feel free to shoot me a message if you have any further questions or problems.
Can we just, like, quickly go over?
Sure. Okay.